Take 12, Side 1, House Committee on the Judiciary, Subcommittee 1, Wednesday, February 21st, 1:30 p.m., Room 350. Public hearing and possible work session, House Bills 2191, 2196, 2197, 2198, and 2199.
All right, I'll call to order Subcommittee 1 of the House Judiciary Committee. Clerk will note the members present, all others are excused. The first bill on our agenda is House Bill 2191, and I have been advised by Mr. Bromka that because the proposed rules of the Council on Court Procedures will be covering this topic, that it would be appropriate, we've been advised that by the bar, that I guess that it would be appropriate to set this matter over and hold it in abeyance pending the determination of what we do with the rules. Is that correct? Okay, so is there anybody that wanted, that thought we were going to hear testimony on House Bill 2191 that wanted to be heard on?
I'd like to hear it later, but it doesn't have to be now.
Okay. Fine. You understand the situation that we're in. We're going through weekly the right. Hearings on the rules, and we just, I think the feeling is that because this is a matter covered by those rules, that we'll await disposition of those. The next matter, then, is House Bill 2196, and Mr. Olson and Mr. Hingson have signed up for that.
Bob Olson with the Oregon State Bar, and all of these bills, 2196, 2197, 2198, 2199, are from the last annual meeting of the State Bar that came out of the Defense of the Indigent Committee, and the bar supports these bills, and we've asked Mr. Hingson to come and provide the testimony on these bills today.
Okay. Mr. Hingson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With regard to House Bill 2196, I would like to explain why the bar felt that an amendment to this statute, ORS 151-220, was in order. The change is an addition of language that prohibits, in all circumstances, the private practice of criminal law by a public defender. The reasons why, before I get into the reasons, I must make it clear that so long as the public defender earns less than $10,000 a year, he or she can still engage in the practice of civil law. The reasons for this amendment were the concern of the Committee on the Defense of the Indigent Accused with the appearance of impropriety of an attorney that was handling indigent defense being able to possibly through that position obtain private representation of those criminally accused. As we're all aware, the United States Supreme Court in the Bates decision has indicated that it is permissible for a lawyer to advertise, but in a pre-Bates decision it has been held that it is impermissible for a lawyer to solicit. As far as the ethical considerations that are concerned here, the committee felt that from the standpoint of the ethics of the individual practitioner, if there was not solicitation, there was possibly the appearance of impropriety that the Oregon State Bar is always ever vigilant to make sure doesn't occur. And that is the major consideration of the committee with regard to this bill.
Okay, Representative Gardner.
Have you asked for an advisory opinion from the Oregon State Bar Committee on Ethics regarding this matter?
Regarding this bill?
Regarding this fact situation.
We have not. I might point out that the American Bar Association standards that were promulgated by the ABA that this legislature has seen fit to implement in its virtual totality with regards to pretrial discovery and pretrial release, where we got rid of the bail system. We now have security release. We have pretrial discovery permitting copies of police reports to be given to defense counsel. In the same area, the American Bar Association standards for the provision of defense services in standard 3.2 state as follows. Insofar as local conditions permit, the defender office should be staffed with full-time personnel. All full-time personnel should be prohibited from engaging in the private practice of law, and part-time personnel should be prohibited from engaging in the private practice of law in criminal cases. Now, former Justice McAllister of the Oregon Supreme Court was involved in the American Bar Association standards with regard to criminal defense and criminal law. We've had our representation in the ABA in this regard. As far as the specific legal ethics question that you posed, I believe that this should be prohibited by disciplinary rule 505, 8101, 2103, and 2104. What I'm reading from is a work by William Snoffer, Criminal Justice Standards in Oregon, that compares the American Bar Association standards with the law in Oregon. It would appear from former Judge Snoffer's analysis that this bill is already really required by the ethics of our profession in this state. I believe, however, that specifically implementing it in the statute is in the interest of the public and is in the interest of the bar, in as much as if we have a prohibitory statute in effect, we will not have the necessity for having a disciplinary proceeding brought against a lawyer that was engaging in the private practice of criminal law while being a public defender.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gardner.
How many people are affected by this provision as far? How many practicing attorneys?
Very few. One of the things that our committee did last year was an attempt at empirical research. And because, as I'm sure you're familiar with bar committees, it's difficult to do any statistical empirical research. But what we did was we wrote questionnaires to the various bar associations in the judicial districts of this state, and we received relatively good response. This will not affect that many practitioners. For instance, in the public defender in Portland does not, I beg your pardon, I believe that 2196 relates to the state public defender. If I can have just a moment to refresh my recollection, I'd like to do that.
That's correct.
That is correct, right. This is not going to affect anybody on the present staff of the public defender's office right now, to my knowledge, mainly because Bob Cannon is now with the Attorney General's office.
Yes, Representative Gardner.
It seems to me that if, in your opinion, this is presently prohibited by the ethics of the profession, that perhaps you might have saved the legislature's time and money and our time by simply asking for an ethics opinion from the Bar Committee on Ethics regarding whether or not this could or could not ethically be done. It seems to me that if that had been answered in the negative by the committee, that would have been clear guidance to the few attorneys that would have been affected by it. Would you agree or disagree with that decision?
Well, most respectfully, Representative Gardner, I must disagree. As you know, legal ethics opinions are advisory in nature. They do not control an issue. They are merely a written opinion by the Committee on Legal Ethics that are eventually approved by the Board of Governors. But I can give you an example of how the legislature's work in this area has been helpful with regard to professional discipline of attorneys. In Chapter 135, there is a provision with regard to plea negotiations that similarly situated defendants shall be afforded equal plea opportunities. In the landmark decision of N. Ray Rook, which was decided by the Oregon Supreme Court in 1976, the Supreme Court of Oregon focused upon this language found in Chapter 135 and used it in assisting it in reaching a conclusion that the conduct in that case was unprofessional. It was a landmark case because there was never such an issue brought before in any jurisdiction in this country. In the same regard, I must point out that there are many overlaps between statutes, for instance, in Chapter 9 of the Oregon Revised Statutes relating to attorneys, that on occasion are mirror images of the Code of Professional Responsibility. The Code of Professional Responsibility can change absent any action on the part of the legislature. However, I feel that in this particularly sensitive area, with regard to the appearance of impropriety and the pride that we can have in this state of having an extremely clean bar, I feel that the interests of the public and the profession indicate that the passage of this bill is in order, despite the fact that the same result may be dictated by our Code of Professional Responsibility.
Okay, just two very quick ones, and I'll let them have
Representative Gregor.
As a practitioner, if there was an advisory opinion handed down by the bar's ethics committee, would you as a practitioner follow that in regards to the question of potential impropriety?
Within the framework of this bill?
Within the framework of an opinion. If the bar's ethics committee handed down in a certain fact situation an opinion that that action constituted a breach of the ethics and that it constituted an appearance of impropriety, would you as a practitioner follow that ethics opinion?
Generally, yes. And the reason I say generally yes is because there is a potential for a conflict between an advisory opinion and a case that the Oregon Supreme Court, who was the chief body eventually charged with the responsibility of the discipline of attorneys, that is entirely possible. And I believe we have essentially that type of situation in existence today with regard to some issues that aren't involved here, particularly in the area of criminal defense. So I would definitely be on the horns of a dilemma if faced with an Oregon Supreme Court disciplinary opinion that directed my conduct in one way and then was faced with an opinion of the Legal Ethics Committee that pointed the other way. I would be in a conflict. So my answer is generally I would follow the Legal Ethics opinion myself personally.
Last question.
Yes, Representative Gardner.
In the Rook case, was there proceedings taken, ethical proceedings taken against Mr. Rook in regards to his actions in the similar situated pleas?
Yes.
Okay, and what was the result of that? Was that the Supreme Court opinion that was rendered?
Yes.
Okay.
I believe it's in 276 Oregon. It was decided in 1976.
So that in that case, the ethics process through the bar was sufficient basically to allow the attorneys to follow whatever the ethical guidelines should or should not be in that particular case.
The court in the Rook case was helped tremendously by the guidance given by the legislature in the passage of that particular language. Similarly situated defendants shall be afforded equal plea opportunities. And I might point out that that language that was adopted by the legislature and put into the plea negotiation section of Chapter 135 was, once again, just like this bill, the spirit and the letter of it was taken from the American Bar Association standards with regard to pleas of guilty.
I have a third question.
Okay. Before I go on, I'd, for the benefit of the students in the audience, like to welcome you to these hearings held by the House Judiciary Committee and explain to you that what we're discussing right now are a couple of bills that have been proposed by the Oregon State Bar that would essentially prohibit those attorneys who are public defenders from also engaging in private practice of law. As I understand it, and Mr. Hinkson, you can correct me if I'm wrong, as I understand it, would prohibit them from engaging in the private practice of law in doing private legal matters for any criminal defendant that they represented. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. That leads to a question then that I have, Mr. Hingston, in just in the language in line 17 of the bill, where it does read, "And in no event shall the defender and any of his deputies engage in private practice of law in criminal cases." I'm not sure if that is really clear as to what we intend, and I think you've already told me that what we really want to do here is prohibit the public defender. Well, I guess what this gets at is the public. Let's say the public defender who receives a salary of less than $10,000 a year from engaging in in handling any private matters, any private legal matters for a criminal defendant whom he represents. Because we have a situation in the first part of the sentence under existing law that says that the defender and his deputies who receive a salary of $10,000 or more shall not engage in private practice at all.
Civil or criminal.
Civil or criminal. Right. That seems to completely wipe out that possibility. So really what we're doing by the amendment in 2196 is addressing as well those public defenders who are under the $10,000, earning under $10,000 in their job, and we're prohibiting them from engaging in any other legal matters for a criminal defendant whom they are representing. Is that correct?
That is correct.
But it would not prohibit them from doing generally civil practice for other individuals.
That is correct.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Excuse me, Representative Smith.
Well, I'm not sure that you have the same understanding that I do of the language that's contained there. You just stated, I believe, Representative Lombard, that a public defender making less than $10,000 a year could not represent one of his criminal clients in a civil matter. And I don't believe this says that at all.
Well, that's my question then to Mr. Hingston.
Could you rephrase that so that I make sure that...
Okay, let's take the example of a public defender who makes $9,000 a year. He's representing someone on a charge of assault. In his capacity as public defender, and the fellow or the defendant says, "By the way, I was injured in an automobile accident last week. Would you handle my personal injury case for me as a private attorney on the outside?" Public defender says, "Yes, I'd be delighted to." I don't think that this prohibition in line 16 and 17 reaches that. And I believe that Representative Lombard felt that it did.
Right. Okay. First of all, this has to do with the state public defender who handles appellate cases.
Okay.
All right. So the likelihood of getting of an inmate in the Oregon State Penitentiary getting involved in an auto accident is not great. But if in the event something like that occurred, this bill would not prohibit, and the law has never prohibited, a defender, a state public defender, earning less than $10,000 from engaging in the private practice of civil law.
Right.
So my answer to your question would be, I think that this bill would not prohibit that.
Okay.
There might be other considerations. I'm just cautious.
I agree, but I thought I understood Representative Lombard to restate the principle in that manner, and I don't see it that way at all.
Well, I really asked it in that manner because I don't think it's clear the way it's written. Representative Gardner.
What's the starting salary for a deputy state public defender?
I'm going to guess, if I may, I think it's somewhere around $14,000.
How many people are there presently that are working for the state public defender's office that are making less than $10,000?
That, I must say, I think is something that's changed recently. What this bill is really talking about is a part-time state public defender. Now, we don't have a history of having part-time state public defenders. Those people are overworked enough as it is, and they work more than full-time. But in one particular instance, a former state public defender went into private practice, and he had been asked on a commission basis, commission for one particular job, because he had specialty in United States Supreme Court certiorari practice, to handle certain cases after he left. And the ABA standards and the committee on the defense of the indigent accused felt that this was not in response to anything that had happened in the state public defender's office. We are more concerned with an early warning system, I believe, here than dealing with an existing problem. Prevention is what's involved. But what the concern was is having a part-time public defender using that, in essence, captive audience of the indigent accused in the penitentiary as a conduit to pick up, if I may say, non-indigent criminal offenders.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
You've talked about that the need for this bill is the appearance of impropriety that may occur through some kind of supposed solicitation. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Is there any less impropriety if a criminal state public defender solicits or appears to solicit a civil case as opposed to a criminal case?
From a professional ethical standpoint, it is equally reprehensible.
Okay. Does the bill speak to that as written?
To solicitation of civil cases?
Correct.
Of course not.
I guess I'm still a bit confused then. The questions that both Representative Smith and I have brought up, what specifically is the fact situation that you're addressing here?
The hypothetical fact situation?
Yes.
The state public defender is engaged in the part-time practice of state public defense appellate work. Because of that representation, he has to go to the Oregon State Penitentiary and meet various inmates that are seeking his counsel and advice. Upon the interview with the inmate, he discovers that the inmate has a ranch in Hardy County worth $250,000. The part-time public defender says to the inmate, "Well, you contacted me because you wanted a public defender. But I see now from speaking with you that you are ineligible for public defender assistance. If you want me to represent you, I will. I happen to have a quitclaim deed, your ranch, in my briefcase, and we'll fill in the legal description now." That is it stated in its, if I may say so, in its most obnoxious form that we are trying to prohibit.
Okay, and so as Representative Smith pointed out to you, then apparently while this would prohibit the public defender from privately representing the inmate in the criminal matters, it would not, on the other hand, prohibit the public defender, the part-time public defender, from handling a real property transaction or a sale of that property or something like that for the inmate. It seems to me that's a very fine line to be drawn in this kind of a case. If why are we drawing that kind of a line?
One of the problems in the area of criminal defense historically has been the temptation to engage in, from the trial standpoint, in lawyers hanging around the halls of the courthouse, making their presence very much aware to the criminal defendants going in and out of the courtroom, and unethically soliciting business. And because you are captively an audience in the criminal law area when you seek a public defender, the interest and the motivation of the potential client for asking for representation is in the criminal law area, not in any civil law area. And that's my answer. I don't know whether that's adequate or not, but that's the concern that the American Bar Association has had because of historical experience. I feel that from the empirical facts that we have from history, that the type of situation of solicitation of civil business, there just isn't that much. And if there is, if that is going to occur, that can be handled quite nicely by the bar through its professional disciplinary proceedings. This, I feel, will make it easier in the sense that we will not have to have an ethics opinion prohibited by statute. We have too many ethics opinions as it is. The desk book in which they're contained is growing at a fantastic rate. We have too many hearings.
Just a comment. Some people have said that our laws and the ORS is growing at even a faster rate than the number of ethics opinions that we have.
In regard to that, I might point out that there are only about 20 words here. I do know they count up, but I think this makes this law, which is already on our books, easier to administrate. And I think that even though we do have a desirous goal to reduce the number of laws and the length of them, we should hopefully strive for ease of administration with the ones that we already have. And this certainly does that.
Let me ask you this. In reality, to addressing a problem that has any possibility or potential of happening, isn't 2197, House Bill 2197, more appropriate where you're addressing the county public defenders? Why don't we, does anybody have any other questions on 2196?
Just one, Mr. Chairman. Has there been an instance or two of rather an ugly violation of this ethical posture that you want to protect? Has somebody gone to the pen and actually perpetrated the type of violation that you described hypothetically, or is that really not a hypothetical?
As a state public defender or something of this nature? No. This is one of the things that our bar should be quite proud of, is that we do have, in a comparative standpoint with the other 49 states.
Okay, you just fear it then. You're not reacting to an actual violation.
Yes, this is preventive law.
Okay, any other questions from committee members on this one? All right, we'll move right on then to 2197. I gather that your statements that you've been making about 2196 really apply in the same fashion to 2197. Would that be correct?
Yes.
And yet we're talking at this level about county public defenders. Let me ask you this. How many counties today in Oregon have a public defender system?
It's difficult to define in the sense that we have an organized public defender in Multnomah County. That is a private nonprofit corporation that contracts with the county to sell bits of representation for a certain dollar figure. In Lane County, we have a public defender. In Douglas County, we have a public defender. In Baker, we have a public defender. And in Coos County, we have a public defender.
Okay. Mr. Chairman? Do you know, excuse me just a second, Representative Smith, do you know in any of these situations, in any of these counties, the public defender is receiving a salary less than $13,000 or $13,000 or less, annual salary of $13,000 or under?
Our committee did not ask that delicate question.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Gardner?
I'll defer to Representative Smith.
Okay.
I think he was first.
Representative Smith, excuse me.
My question is, I believe there may be a statute similar to these in existence already, Dennis, related to district attorneys. and that a part-time district attorney in Baker County, for example, can have a private practice of law if he makes less than $12,000 a year on the county budget. And I'm not sure whether the parallel language is in that statute, but the district attorney being a prosecutor of criminal defendants, it'd be interesting for me to know whether this language is incorporated in the district attorney statute. And it seems to me there's a great parallelism in here, and probably the same ethical concerns, or many of the same ethical concerns.
Let me ask Mr. Hankson if there's anything you want to add by way of your testimony, other than what you've already given us on 2196. Do you want to add anything on 2197?
I just might point out that we have a tripartite system of providing indigent defense throughout the counties. We have the ability to have a so-called rotating list that is extant in some counties. We have the public defender system that is in the counties that I mentioned. And then we have the private association for provision of indigent defense that is involved in the county where I practice, Clackamas County. Because of this diversity, and I might point out that that diversity of the three systems of providing indigent defense once again finds support in the American Bar Association standards again. But with regard to 2197, where we're focusing on the county provision of indigent defense, not at the appellate level, but at the trial level, this bill will cover more people and more fact situations.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gardner.
Do you know of any public defenders that are practicing either criminal or civil law on the side?
I can't name one, but I, for some reason in the back of my mind, it seems like in one of the counties in either the central or eastern Oregon, that is done.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay. Yes, Dennis?
In response to Representative Smith's point, ORS 8.726 states, a district attorney or a deputy district attorney who receives an annual salary of more than $18,000 from the state or from the state and the county shall not engage in the private practice of law. It could be that that figure, $18,000, is more in line with current wages and salary levels, and that one of the problems with the bill is in line 6 of the figure, $13,000. Maybe that's out of date. And the bill could be made more meaningful if you attacked it from that direction.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Gardner.
Just the opposite. I think as long as you leave it at $13,000, you basically have a statutory provision that doesn't allow you to practice any law, which takes care of the exact situation that the witness is trying to stop.
Okay.
So as long as we leave the figure at $13,000,
you don't need the amendment.
You don't need the bill. That's existing statutory language.
And the only question is, my question is to whether we know in any of these counties where we have
someone
public
doing
defenders, if we've got anybody earning less than $13,000. Although, again, that really speaks more to the prohibition against engaging in law, and we're talking about the different issue here. We're talking about the issue regardless of what your salary is. We're talking solely about the issue of whether the county public defender can engage in the private practice in a criminal case, which, again, I guess we interpret or we understand from your testimony simply means that once engaged or having discussed the representation of a defendant in a criminal case as a public defender, you cannot thereafter attempt or agree to represent that individual on a fee basis.
There's something that I think that I should add. Lawyers are like blushing high school girls traditionally. I know we've been termed something other than that on occasion, but we have always had to be asked for the date. Will you go out with me Friday night? Will you represent me in this homicide case? We cannot go to the client and say, I would like to take you out or I would like to take your case. That is unethical. A lawyer that was practicing in a small community who was doing a diligent job to specialize in criminal defense should not be in a situation of having been beaten to the punch, as it were, by his sole competitor, who happens to have already talked to the client, merely because he has a part-time public defender position. One of the philosophical underpinnings of the Bates decision was that competition in the area of the practice of law is healthy, and that is sometimes a violation of our antitrust laws to have minimum fee schedules. And it is essentially unfair, in addition to the spectacle of the unethical conduct, it's unfair to the other practitioners in the community to have a part-time public defender have such a beautiful built-in conduit of business that has nothing to do with how desirable a date or lawyer he may be, he or she may be.
Let me ask you this. Is it further the intent of this language, taking your public defender, to prohibit that public defender from engaging in any criminal defense work for a fee?
Could you restate that again?
Is it the intent of the language of this bill says, in no event shall the public defender engage in private practice of law in criminal cases, to prohibit a public defender, regardless of what his income, to prohibit a public defender from representing defendants in any criminal case for a fee?
Yes.
In other words, it cuts all the way across the board. It doesn't just cover the situation of the hypothetical that you gave us a while ago. In other words, I guess I was a little bit confused with your hypothetical, because you talked about the public defender who goes out to the state pen on the pretense of representing somebody who claims to be indigent, and you find out he doesn't qualify for indigency, and so takes on the case on a fee basis. Let's just take the situation where you've got the part-time public defender, and Joe Blow walks in off the street and says, I'm being charged with a felony, will you represent me? I can pay you. And your intent is to say, under no circumstance can you do any criminal defense work on a fee basis, regardless what your income is.
Yes.
Okay, I think I have a better understanding of it now then. Much clearer understanding.
One of the situations that we find in the practice of law is that the public doesn't know enough about law and lawyers. They're generally afraid of us because they're afraid of what it's going to cost them to walk into an office. And people frequently talk about getting the public defender to handle their divorce case. Well, the public defender doesn't handle divorce cases. That's handled by legal aid. But people frequently think public defender. And if you look in the phone book for public defender and you are able to pay, if you go into that office and there's a potential for the individual attorney that greets you to represent you on a fee basis, it gives the appearance of impropriety and solicitation, if not the actuality of it, and it also creates an unhealthy situation as far as competition.
Okay, but within this one fell swoop, then you're also going to take, let's say, the county public defender who might be earning less than $13,000 a year, who might have a civil practice, and he's got a very good paying client that he does a lot of business work for, and the client stubs his toe and gets a DUI or something like that, and the client comes to him and says, well, you represent me. You're wiping him out of that situation, aren't you?
Yes.
Which is really the unfortunate extension of it, where there really, in fact, is no impropriety, because public defender has civilly represented the individual for a long time.
Certainly. This is one of the problems that comes about when you have a law that's easy to administer.
Any other questions for members of the committee? OK. Okay, thank you, Mr. Hankson. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify either on House Bill 2196 or House Bill 2197? Kind of taking these together. All right, I'll close the public hearing on those two bills. We'll go on to House Bill 2198. And Mr. Hankson, I see that you're signed up also on that one, so why don't you go ahead on House Bill 2198.
The present law has a so-called fee schedule in it for payment of attorneys representing indigent accused. For instance, if an attorney represents an indigent accused on a misdemeanor and enters a plea of guilty, that lawyer is paid $25. For instance, if the person goes to trial on a plea of not guilty, the lawyer gets a fee of $50 per day of trial, not exceeding 2 days in any one case. And similar provisions are made for representation of felonies. Subsection F of present 135.055.1 provides, in extraordinary circumstances, payment in excess of the limits stated herein may be made if the presiding judge continuing on. I must say that the extraordinary circumstances are the rule as opposed to the exception at the present time. In the committee in which I have been active, the Indigent Accused Committee, we found that most counties pay in excess of these statutory guidelines. Now, there are many things wrong with having set dollar figures in the statutory guidelines. First of all, they immutably set a dollar figure for certain services that are performed with no ability for adjustment in inflation. And secondly, these figures are quite unreasonable as far as the dollar figures are concerned. While $50 a day may seem like a lot of money to some people, to the lawyer that has an overhead of paying secretarial help, buying office equipment, paying for stationery, telephones, etc., I can assure you that a law office, like where I practice, cannot run on $50 a day. And if an accused who happens to be so unfortunate to be indigent has a lawyer that knows that he or she will only get $50 for that day of representation, that lawyer is going to be doubly taxed. And I would like to explain what I mean by that. First of all, the lawyer is having property taken away from that individual, i.e. money, on the basis of representing the indigent accused, because it's going to cost more than $50 in order to proceed. One study indicates that it costs $15 to write a letter for a lawyer. And if charging $15 per letter a lawyer isn't going to make any money, I suggest to you that there should at least be one letter written in a misdemeanor case. So now we're down to $35, the letter being a demand for discovery. The lawyer is losing money by representing this client for $50 a day. Not only is the lawyer losing money at $50, but that lawyer is being taxed by the state and the federal government on that income. The long and the short of it is that this fee schedule assures economic disaster for a lawyer that represents the indigent accused if this fee schedule and guideline, the statute, is followed. Now, it is not a pleasant topic, but I can assure you that it is reality that I'm talking about, that to a certain extent, justice is for sale. The more that you pay for your criminal defense lawyer, hopefully, and then generally, the better representation you're going to receive. The more that you pay for a car, the higher quality of an automobile you're going to obtain. The more you pay, generally, for a heart surgeon, the better heart surgery you're going to get. And the same is true with regard to criminal defense. The less you pay is the other side of the coin. The less that is paid, the poorer the quality of the job is done. Now, why should there be any concern about that? There is a constitutional reason that we should be concerned about the quality of justice. Since the Supreme Court case of Gideon versus Wainwright was decided, we have tried to follow in this country, and particularly in this state, the slogan that appears above the United States Supreme Court building, equal justice under law. And we should not, in this state or in any state in this country, discriminate as to a fair trial on the basis of the individual's right to hire a lawyer.
Okay, Representative Smith.
Jack, as you know, the counties are strapped for money right now to pay for indigent defense, and you're probably aware that there's a bill before this committee now to come up with money from the state general fund to pick up the cost of indigent defense, or a substantial portion of it. If this committee were to pass out this bill, pretty much throwing it open to reasonable payment for indigent defense, and then failed to turn around and offer the counties any method or any funds to pay for that indigent defense, aren't we just burdening the various county jurisdictions with something that they can't handle?
One of the things that is involved here is the big picture. And when we isolate the cost of indigent defense as an item alone, there is a possibility that this would strap the counties, as you've indicated. But in the big picture, the answer is no. Now, I brought something with me today that I can leave here, and it is published by the American Bar Association, and it's a booklet entitled How State and Local Governments Can Economize by Implementing Criminal Justice Standards. Since the case of Rook versus Cup, different than the Rook case previously mentioned, was decided in the early 70s in this state by our Oregon Court of Appeals, we have had a standard for the provision of defense services to people, indigents, or those that can pay, that ineffective assistance of counsel occurs not when the representation of the lawyer resulted in the trial being a farce and mockery of justice. That's the traditional standard. Since Rook versus Cup was decided, we have had the standard, what would a reasonably competent criminal practitioner have done? And if a reasonably competent criminal practitioner would have done one thing, and the lawyer representing, for instance, this indigent did another, post-conviction relief remedies or habeas corpus would be available to that indigent in this state. What is entailed in habeas corpus? First of all, I'll have to back up and say, once the accused has been convicted in the violation of the rule of Rook versus Cup by an ineffective lawyer, there must be an appeal. Can ineffective assistance of counsel be raised on appeal? The Oregon Court of Appeals says virtually never. In rare instances, the Chief Judge Schwab has said that it may be, but that rare instance hasn't happened yet. So we have the appeal process. And it will behoove any careful practitioner to preserve his client's rights to raise it on appeal and then turn around and come back to the Marion County Circuit Court, file a petition for post-conviction relief, have an evidentiary hearing, get the lawyer from the county where the conviction occurred, get the prosecutor as a witness, get the judge as a witness if necessary, have expert witnesses testify what a reasonably competent criminal practitioner would do, have a 2, 3, 4, 5 day post-conviction relief trial, and then have the judge decide the case one way or the other, permit the state to appeal if the result was adverse to them, permit the defendant to appeal if the result was adverse to him, have the transcript prepared at an enormous expense. I might point out, always the court reporter gets paid better than the indigent defense lawyer. Send the case to the Court of Appeals, and have them decide the case after extensive research and briefing, pay the public defender again, or if it's a retained attorney, pay him again, and put this unbelievable burden on our already overburdened trial and appellate court system. It is a microscopic view that says that providing competent criminal defense at the trial level is too expensive and a luxury that we can't afford. From the standpoint of the entire criminal justice system, in the event that we have a retrial, we've got to have all the police come back. We've got to have all the prosecution team come back. We've got to do this all over again. And I can assure you that in the long run, the provision of competent and adequate criminal defense at the trial level in the first instance is far more economical to the counties than what we've seen, like in the newspaper this morning. I believe 5 serious felony cases resulted in reversals. Now,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Jack, you know how many counties still require, if any, that members of the local bar association accept court-appointed criminal defense cases? Are there counties that still do that?
The majority of them do not.
Is that because of the creation of public defender in some cases, and secondly, because there seem to be a willing number of local practitioners who will take these cases?
Yes, the willing number is dwindling. And the people that are dwindling off of it are competent criminal practitioners.
Most experienced. For your information, we have had in this committee a conversation relating to some other bills, primarily the Indigent Defense Funding Bill, along this line. And so your background is helpful, although we have gone over a lot of this. I'd like you to speak then to the direct language of the bill rather than argue to us about the change in cost, because I think we're all pretty aware of that.
All right. One of the particular response to you, Representative Smith, I would like to call this committee's attention. The standard in domestic relations that is used for the determination of attorney fees. And I cite to this committee the case of Kolboth versus Kolboth, 15 Oregon Appeals, 568, a 1973 case. The standard that is used for the court in setting attorney fees in domestic relations cases is the amount of time spent on the case, the complexity of the issues involved, the value of the interests involved, the skill and standing of counsel, and the nature of the proceedings, as well as the results secured. This is the standard that the courts follow in determining an attorney's fee in a divorce case. Ethics prohibit a lawyer from charging a different fee in a criminal case on the basis of a result. So that standard could never apply in a criminal matter. The language that is contained in House Bill 2198 is in part taken from the language used to set attorney fees in divorce cases. And that language, in turn, came from the Code of Professional Responsibility. So the thing that is important that this bill talks to is that the correct factors are considered as opposed to factors that have nothing whatsoever to do with what an attorney fee should be. I've already spoken to how inadequate and unrelated to the value of the services $50 per day for a misdemeanor trial is. I would like to make something known about my practice. On occasion, I represent indigents accused. For me to take, if I took an indigent case here under these statutory guidelines, I'd like to explain to you what it would be in my private practice as opposed to if I was representing an indigent accused. For instance, in the normal type of trial that takes a day for me to try is a driving under the influence charge. If I went to trial as opposed to had a plea of guilty under these statutes, I'd be entitled to $50. When I represent a citizen accused of this charge, driving under the influence, my attorney fees are from $1,500 to $2,000 plus expert witness fees, if any.
Is that higher than the average going rate in the metropolitan area?
It certainly is. I must say that the average rate in the metropolitan area is around $750 for a driving under the influence trial. Now, if I tried one case like this a day, I would make $250 in a week. If I tried five DUI cases in a week, I would be ready for representation by counsel in civil commitment proceedings to Damish Hospital. It's impossible to do. I limit myself to two trials, one-day trials per week, and it is a grueling schedule, I can guarantee you, two jury trials. What this type of situation does is it drives out the private practitioner that can do this type of work, and I must guarantee everyone on this committee that it is complex work. It is of the utmost complexity, any criminal defense is. The law changes every day. I should have brought an advance sheet to so you could read. The advance sheets that we get from the Court of Appeals on a weekly basis look like telephone books, the yellow pages from Portland, and it seems as if half of the cases are criminal. And we have to keep on top of those because with the standard of Rook versus Cup, if we're not on top of those, we're going to render ineffective assistance of counsel, and we can be open for civil liability, for malpractice, and then we can also have the problem of reversals and retrials that we should all be against.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Hinkson. First of all, and I'm just wondering if your committee did any studies on this, we've had this statutory schedule in here for a while, but to your knowledge, are there any counties today in the state who are, in fact, allowing only these statutory fees? I know, for instance, that Jackson County just recently revised theirs up significantly upward. And so I'm just wondering if to your knowledge, there are any counties that are allowing only what is allowed by statute here. I can see Representative Smith and Gardner whispering loudly something about Washington County. Is that...
And Multnomah.
I have to say, Mr. Chairman, Washington County has recently, that's within the last 4 months, doubled these figures so that you get now 50 and 100.
Upon federal strike by the Washington County Bar Association,
yeah,
I might point out.
There was a collective bargaining type action taken by the Bar Association to no longer represent people accused of criminal.
What union do you belong to?
Okay, outside of Washington and Multnomah counties, did you make any statewide studies?
Yes, we did make a statewide study. Like I said, this subsection F, in extraordinary circumstances, it appears that extraordinary circumstances are the rule rather than the exception. But there's a problem that is generated as a result of the independent method of payment aside apart from the statutory guidelines. The ipsy dixit ad hoc manner in which counsel is paid is a source of continuing frustration to the criminal defense practitioner that on occasion represents the indigent citizen accused. And it frequently has nothing to do with issues that are proper, namely the nature of the charge and the complexity of the case. I can cite an example of a fine criminal defense lawyer in Portland, Oregon that was successful in stopping criminal prosecution of his client at the grand jury stage on a murder charge. Now, that is the most complex of any charge on our books at the present time, and it is the most serious. This gentleman was a court-appointed lawyer. The ego satisfaction of having 12 good and true come into the courtroom and look the defendant in the eye and say not guilty is tremendous. But it is much better to have your client never indicted by the grand jury. That's what he secured. And what did he get paid?
$50 under the schedule.
$50.
Let me ask you this, then, and if we go to the standard that you suggested here, reasonable compensation, would this negate
the ability of a county to, in fact, follow a set fee arrangement? Would it prohibit a county from establishing a set fee arrangement such as is established here?
Of course not. What we have in Clackamas County at the present time is something that is somewhat like this. There are some things wrong with it, but we do have a set rate for felony trials and for misdemeanor trials, and it is not so far out of line that it's unworkable. For instance, the worst part is $100 per day for a misdemeanor trial. I think it's $500 per day for a felony trial.
So in Jackson County, we'll get $300 a day for both misdemeanor and felony trials.
I sweat just as much in felony court as in
Well, I know what you mean. But you don't see your language here, and certainly not the intent of your committee, to prohibit the counties from establishing a fee schedule.
No, I think it's quite consistent with the spirit of this language that has been done, so long as it was reasonable compensation for representation following the statutory language.
My second question would be this. Why, well, I think I already know the answer why, but you think it's practical to remove the county governing body from the approval arrangement for the fee schedule or fees? Since they're paying right now, and less than until we pass House Bill 2002, and even then that would not bear the full bore of the charges. Do you think that it's practical to remove the county from the process of approving the schedule or approving the fees?
I think they, under the application of the present law, they've already been removed from it.
Well, they haven't in our instance. In fact, we had to go, as Representative Gardner indicated, apparently what you did in Washington County, you went to the county commissioners and said, unless you raise it, you won't have any defense attorneys at all. Fortunately, we haven't had to do that in Jackson County. We've had a very cooperative commission, and we were able to go to them about 6 months ago, actually July 1st of last year, of 78, went to them and said, here, we've been on a schedule since 1971. We feel it's time to adjust it upwards. Here's the cost of running a law office and, you know, the same line that you've given us. We know that. We actually were able to convince our commissioners to up that fee schedule. And I tell you right now, from a practical standpoint, I think you'd find the members of this committee very reluctant to remove the county governing body from at least the basic fee determination, because in fact the county has to pay the bill.
Right.
They have to budget for it.
Sure. Looking at the language that's been changed here, and the language is the same, the language is still the same, that shall be paid by the county, shall, by order of the court, be paid by the county in which the proceeding is had. Now, we're going to get in the situation, possibly, where the court is going to order something that the county can't pay. I have yet to see that happen in this state. I've yet to hear it happen in this state.
Yeah, we hear a few different stories from the county commissioners. Representative Gardner.
If this bill were presently the way the system works, and I think you've testified accurately, is that, okay, this schedule exists, the attorneys come in under subsection F, and I, just as a matter of course, put down subsection F and request more money because, you know, you've got more money into it, and sometimes I'm successful and sometimes I'm not. But if you put the language in that you have reasonable compensation for representation in the case commensurate with the nature of the charge and complexity of the case, if you have that language, and that, say you got a fee that you did not feel was reasonable, do you believe that would create a right of action in the attorney in that particular case to challenge the payment by the county? That ipso facto was not reasonable?
That could possibly be a matter that could be raised in the proceeding itself.
Do you think that that's good public policy to engender litigation, which I guess could cost both the private attorney and the county time and effort to collect what each party thought was or was not a reasonable fee?
I don't believe it would be a separate suit. I think it could be, just like in a divorce case, it could be an issue raised on appeal.
Well, if the judge says, if the judge came in and let me give you a fact situation. This is an accurate fact situation. 2-day felony trial in Washington County. Must have been 20 witnesses. Great deal of preparation. And the fee that's awarded at the end of the case is $250. Okay. If this language was in effect, and this was the law, do you think the defense attorney would have settled for the $250 fee, or do you think that he would have attempted to bring some kind of proceeding to get more than $250 because he felt that wasn't reasonable?
There could possibly be a matter that would be handled within the framework of that case itself by appellate review.
What if you're an acquittal?
That could possibly... There is a possibility, although this does not create a cause of action by its terms. That is a possibility.
Let me put it to you more succinctly and more directly to the point. I was the attorney in that case.
Yes.
I was very unhappy with the amount of fee that I got. Okay, I asked for more money and the judge gave me $250. If this had been the language in the statute, I would have filed an action against the county.
If you're asking me to represent you, I...
you would have represented
me. I would be delighted to be an expert witness for you with regard to the value of your services. One of the things that we can't forget, we're talking about public policy here and what's good for this state. I tell you that it is not good for this state for a fine lawyer from Mount Vernon, Oregon, who wears a red tie, that's a bow tie, who was a brilliant man and a fine lawyer to represent a man named Bopel Daka, who made legal history in this country in a case called Bopel Daka versus Oregon, to be paid in less than 4 figures for 90 days of trial. That makes my citizens as well as my lawyer's stomach wretch. There is no reason in 20th century America for us to be possessed of the myth that lawyers are blue-stocking rich people in this state, that because of a commitment to a concept of noblesse oblige, that because they represent the corporate octopus, 99% of the time they can give up all a mere day or two for a trial and absorb the cost and the economic loss that's engendered by this kind of representation. We can't labor under that misconception any longer. Oregon is in the cellar as far as income of lawyers. We're in the bottom 5% nationally. The number of young lawyers that are coming out of law schools that are in our bar is increasing each year. Some studies are about to come out that show that Mr. Olson can give you information on this, but I believe the information is that the lawyer's income average in the state is less than $10,000. I would ask any electrician or plumber to stay in my house for 8 hours for $50.
If you find it, let me know.
Yes.
Representative Richards hasn't had a chance to ask a question yet.
You kept saying over and over and over in your testimony, you're losing so much, you're losing so much, you're losing so much. I certainly hope that when you're seeking a higher compensation, you're not thinking about profit in terms of indigent defense. I am not a lawyer, and I have to say that I feel that if I took the minutes of this hearing, the last hour of this hearing, and read them on the floor of the House, there might be... there might be some real serious repercussions.
Six of us would be run out on a rail.
I have a real concern about the quality of indigent defense. And I recognize that $50 a day can't begin to cover your expenses. And I'm not saying that I don't think there ought to be an increase in what you're allotted for indigent defense. But I have a real concern about the quality of indigent defense. And I've heard some concern in your voice as well, and want to ask you not a directly pertinent question, but maybe a collateral one, about your recommendation on how we can address the quality of indigent defense and make sure if we're getting what we pay for.
House Bill 2199 addresses that.
Yeah.
Well, are you planning to testify on that bill?
I believe so. Yes.
Good. Then I'll defer my question to him.
Representative Gardner.
Do you take court appointed cases?
On occasion.
Okay. Is the rationale or the reason that you take court appointed cases the compensation you receive?
No.
Okay. If I might, Mr. Sherman.
Go ahead.
Isn't there really, at a bottom line, something else that encourages you to take court-appointed cases?
My heart.
Okay. Isn't it true, from a practical point of view, that we're never going to be able, for practical matter, to give you the amount of money that you're entitled to receive or should receive in court-appointed cases?
Yes, and I understand that. Don't quarrel with it.
Okay. Isn't it better than, if you agree with all those answers, isn't it better than really to take the position that I guess maybe there's some kind of a fee schedule that's updated or some kind of standard customary practice that occurs on a county-by-county basis, and then allow for the extraordinary case where someone's going to totally get screwed, rather than putting into law the language you have here, which has the ability, I suppose, potentially, to bankrupt the counties?
We have a mandate from the United States Supreme Court that we cannot violate, and we have a mandate from the Oregon Supreme Court that we cannot violate, that the indigent is going to get competent defense. And the standard is what a reasonably competent criminal practitioner would do. There is nothing that we can do about that. We have to follow that mandate.
Okay.
And my comment before about the economic realities of the situation, I hope it wasn't misconstrued. From a personal standpoint, a situation somewhat similar to what you were involved with. I represented a young man on a burglary charge and spent 5 days on a motion to suppress evidence and 4 days in a jury trial. I sent in the so-called voucher to my county, and I times the number of hours I spent in the defense of that young man times zero. I represented a man for free on a petition to the United States Supreme Court for writ of certiorari, something that's not required under the guidelines of the United States Supreme Court and what you're required to do as a criminal defense lawyer. But a very interesting search and seizure question was raised. I find that's the exception, that we have it in the area of the United States Supreme Court, because that is quite difficult work. But I can say that it is the rule that lawyers are working longer and harder than is good for their health, frequently, for people that are indigent. And I think that we can be proud as a state of the quality of the defense services that are provided for the indigent accused, despite the insulting fees that lawyers are given for that work. The net result that we have to realize is that there is a crisis that's coming upon us, and it's a real crisis. We're seeing it in my county. Who can try homicide cases in Clackamas County that's on this panel of lawyers in this private nonprofit corporation? I don't want to name names, but the people that can do it, that have done it, and that have done it successfully by having those sweet words, "not guilty," said after the charge murder has been levied against their client, are dropping like flies from that organization. And Clackamas County provides more compensation and more reasonable compensation than most counties in this state. And this is a reality that is there. And it is not out of any self-aggrandizement for lawyers that I make these comments. I hope they haven't been misconstrued.
Okay.
I can't emphasize the dedication that I've seen, particularly young lawyers that have their heart into this type of work. And I can tell you that it is not easy work at all, emotionally or intellectually.
Excuse me.
Representative Cohen.
Yes, could I ask you who's now in charge of the lawyers group that handles the defense in Clackamas County?
Yes.
Is that Ward?
Pardon me?
What's his name? Could you tell me the name of the person?
Robert Kester is the administrator. He's a former police chief in Oregon City. He has a secretary, Jamila Niederheiser. There's a board of directors of lawyers that handles executive aspects of the job.
Thank you.
Okay, are there questions, members of the committee? Let me follow up on the question that Representative Gardner asked you, though, is looking at an alternative approach, if the committee should consider this or want to consider this, would you see it as a viable alternative to return to the original language of the bill but set higher amounts, higher specific sums?
One of the things that doesn't do, just adjusting these things upward, that doesn't address itself to what is the reasonable basis for an attorney fee. The number of hours that you spend on a case is something that should be taken into consideration with regard to pretrial preparation. For instance, there's the famous case of Hugh Duffy Brown versus Multnomah County District Court that resulted in the holding of unconstitutionality of the OII infraction law, requiring now, by constitutional mandate, a jury trial on the standard of proof beyond reasonable doubt in the DUII infraction, which everybody thought was a civil animal. Eldon Rosenthal handled that case, didn't spend one day in trial. That case was handled through the appellate courts. That was not a trial. In regard to a motion to suppress evidence, say in a narcotics case, you don't spend a day in trial if you have a five-day motion to suppress evidence. Is it worth nothing? No.
Would you suggest then that perhaps in looking at the different types of proceedings that we could, as an alternative, expand on the number of proceedings that would be covered under this itemization, subparagraphs A through F, to cover some of the more common proceedings. I note in looking at this itemization here, for instance, that there are a number of itemizations that we have on our Jackson County schedule that aren't even on here. I'm just asking that as a possible alternative, because I must say that one of the, as I indicated earlier, I think one of the concerns of the committee will definitely be the impact that this will have on a county's ability to budget for this item. We can't look at it, and a majority of us are lawyers, so we empathize and understand the situation very clearly. You don't have to convince us of that problem, but we also have to look at it from the standpoint of a county's ability to budget this kind of an item. Even if we come in as a state under House Bill 2002 and say we'll give you some money at the local level, even if we provide the state take over the funding 100% for homicide cases, we have to be cognizant of giving the counties a standard, or some kind of standards that they can use and follow for budgetary purposes. That's why I asked the question earlier, whether in your interpretation, the language simply reasonable compensation, whether or not it would prohibit a county from adopting a set fee arrangement, because I think in most cases, most counties would prefer to go to a set fee arrangement so they then could have a somewhat of a reasonable basis to build their budget around.
One of the things that I can say with regard to, for instance, Clackamas County, where I'm most familiar, I think if this bill was the law today, there wouldn't be any difference in the way that indigent defense is funded or administered in Oregon City. Because we have just like the concept of federalism, we should let the counties experiment with different ideas. Because what might be right in Jackson County may be wrong in Multnomah County. And our counties are diverse enough in this state that we need to encourage that experimentation, because Malheur County might come up with the best idea of anybody, and it might catch on somewhere else. But this bill, I don't think would really change that much what's going on, because as I indicated, it's not that many counties, as we know, that still strictly adhere to this. What we're really doing is going under subsection F, the Extraordinary Circumstances Statute, and with these guidelines, everything is extraordinary. And as far as the way that the indigent defense is administered in the counties that I'm familiar with, it would not change it that much. I might point out that within this area of reasonableness, we are quite familiar in the law with the interpretation of reasonableness by an appellate court.
I think our problem is going to be with the county commissions. Everything, Gardner?
I think we need to move on.
I'm ready to move on. I think the bill's going to need some consideration.
Let me say this, Mr. Hinkson. This is just a statement. I have some very direct self-interest in this because a portion, at least, of my practice is criminal defense work, and a large portion of that practice is appointed criminal defense work. And I don't think there's anything more frustrating to anyone than to be in a situation where you get on a case and you work on it and you do everything you can, and then you don't get anything for it financially. And it takes away from the rest of your practice, and people have gone broke. People who are well-meaning people, well-intentioned people have gone broke because they get into a court-appointed situation and then they don't get compensated, and their overheads them, and those kinds of things happen. I've even been in a situation where I've known that I was right in defending a criminal indigent person. Lost all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court, filed a writ of habeas corpus when it was allowed in U.S. District Court, and been in a situation where, because of some technicalities in the case, I was going to have to fork out $250 out of my own pocket to go to the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, and perhaps even beyond that to the U.S. Supreme Court, and known that I could have won the case at some point, even though I'd lost it up to that point. Known that I would have won the case at some point and had to let it go. Just could not financially afford to carry the cost of the case myself. And I don't think that's good public policy either. But your bill is defective in the sense that I don't think that we can afford financially to put the counties in the position that you potentially could put them in with the bill. I understand everything you say, because
most respectfully, I suggest the contrary, that you can't afford not to. Because let me give an example of what competent criminal defense can do. In Washington County, when the public defender came in, after the first year, the number of felony filings went down. Well, now that isn't... The public defender didn't go to Washington County and catch more crooks and put them away and reduce the crime rate. When vigorous, competent criminal defense came to Washington County, where there was semi-adequate compensation for those people, the prosecution learned to filter its cases more carefully and not bring as many charges. The resultant drop in the judicial workload was enjoyed. Less officers were off the road in court testifying as opposed to protecting citizens. This whole area, as I indicated, should not be viewed microscopically. We have the criminal justice system that includes the police, the prosecution, the judges, and probation, parole. This is a big area. And as I indicated, I will leave this with you. The counties can save money by giving competent defense and paying double for it. I can tell you that I have been involved in a number of appeals where I have been a criminal defense lawyer as the indigent defendant's attorney and have given competent, I hope, criminal defense services. The more honest that you keep the prosecution, the tighter you make them follow the law, there are some tremendous consequences of that. If a person is convicted fairly and receives a fair trial in the first instance, if they go to prison and come out, I think that the lawyers that have any contact with those type of people, and they eventually are going to come out of the Oregon State Penitentiary eventually, are going to be a better candidate for rehabilitation if they've received a fair trial. And there's a lower likelihood of recidivism. And what is that going to do? That's going to reduce the need for more criminal defense lawyers. The experience in Washington County is a joy to behold. The budget request, if my memory serves me correctly, for the public defender in Washington County for the second year was less than it was the first year. And the number of filings went down.
I think, Mr. Hankson, in these matters, these are things, of course, that as long as we're still going to go into the system we're under now, we will have to convince the counties in their own regards, even if we go under a reasonable compensation thing. I want to move on now because I think we've pretty well covered this part of 2198. Mr. Clayton Patrick has signed up. So, Mr. Patrick.
Members, my name is Clayton Patrick. I represent Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I'll try to be fairly brief. We support Senate Bill 2198. We too have a real concern about the quality of the defense that is given to indigent defendants. You asked the question about which counties just follow this system. Perhaps a year since I've done it, but at least when I did it a year ago, Marion County was also just simply for misdemeanors, at least in district court, for misdemeanors, just simply following the $25-$50 rule. And if you had a case that went to trial, you got $50, even though you may have spent, you know, days investigating and witnesses and the whole thing. I can certainly see some of your concerns about the standards. I'm certain that our members would prefer the bill as it's drafted with regard to the reasonable compensation language, leaving it up to the court's discretion to determine that. Now, if it was necessary to coordinate that language with other statutes in which the court has the discretion to set the amount of the attorney's fees to avoid this question of an independent right of action in the attorney to sue for fees, I'm certain that we could live with that. We could probably also live with a more reasonable fee schedule as well, but it would seem to me to be more logical to pattern the statute after other kinds of situations where attorney's fees are provided for. As far as the deletion of the language on line 6 of the bill, which refers to the approval of the governing body of the county, I can see where you'd have some concerns about eliminating that language, but by the same token, I'd just like to point out that the county governing body may be more concerned with what it's going to cost them and less concerned with what the constitutional requirements are.
Exactly.
I certainly don't think that their approval ought to be required in every case. I'm certain that doesn't happen now. If there were to be a fee schedule approved, that might be a different story, but I think the primary consideration should be the constitutional requirement and the provision of adequate defense for the indigent defendant. What typically happens, especially in the district court, as I'm sure those of you who practiced criminal law know, is that quite often you have young attorneys just starting out availing themselves of this method of getting cases. And it's very difficult for any young attorney to get started. I certainly don't think they should be able to get rich. I don't think you even want to have this bill provide, you know, a profit or an equal compensation to a private case, but I certainly think that it ought to be more reasonable than it is. I mentioned to a couple of committee members, and would just mention it on the record, we had hoped to have today for you an amendment to this bill, but unfortunately, as I discovered, the attorney that I'd asked to draft the amendment has gone on vacation, and we didn't realize at the time that he left that the bill was coming up this quickly. I would tell you that briefly it would cover a situation that has arisen as a result of a couple of court cases where there is not a provision for payment of indigent defense costs on appeal in habeas cases and on appeal in mental commitment cases. There are defense costs provided at the initial stages, and there are defense costs provided for appeal of regular criminal cases, but the court has taken a strict, narrow reading of the statutes, and they've said unless it's provided by the statute, there's no fee paid for an indigent person involved in a habeas case when it's appealed, nor in a mental commitment case when it's appealed, and we'll have some language as soon as we possibly can to the committee on that. Unless there are questions, I think that's all I have.
Any questions from committee members? Mr. Stamp? Yes, Representative Richards?
I guess I'd just like to, in general, raise the question of juvenile counsel and compensation for juvenile counsel and how either of you might feel about including that in this bill.
I haven't done any juvenile practice, so I'm not even certain what the situation is. If you know what the situation
is. There is no requirement now in the law, although there is in case law and juvenile revocation procedures, for example, that I have a communication that says the compensation is that much lower, even, for juvenile representation.
I'm certain it probably is.
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, my experience, which is rather extensive in Multnomah County Juvenile Court, is that they pay approximately $15 an hour, and it's on an hourly rate. It's based on an affidavit by the attorney to the Multnomah County Circuit Court, and I suppose that is at least a subsistence or maybe a break-even at cost type of rate. I don't know whether that operates I don't know that operates statewide, but
no, Jackson County would pay $37.50 an hour, but please don't come to Jackson County. We have a very bad air pollution problem down there, and lots of smog. And, I know that you wouldn't like it.
The ski slopes are closed too, right?
Well, the answer to Representative Richards' question, I think that there certainly should, in that situation as well, be adequate compensation provided. And if it were to be added into this bill, Oregon Trial Lawyers, I'm certain would support it. You've kind of caught me off guard. I don't recall that I've seen a bill like this, but I know there are a tremendous number of bills that came out of the Juvenile Task Force that are in the Senate, and I don't know whether there's a bill that's provided for that or not, but that might be something that should be looked at.
There's not one that addresses compensation.
There isn't.
Is it your interpretation of this bill, then, that the matter of reasonable compensation is something that would be determined solely by the court?
That's how I would interpret this as it's drafted. But it might not be a bad idea to look at some comparable statutes to see if the language in comparable statutes, for example, the domestic relations cases and other cases where the attorney's fees are provided by or set by the court, to see that it's comparable. If it's comparable, then I should think the interpretation would be the same.
Now, I think you've got to understand this, that when we're talking about reasonable attorney's fees, may be allowed in domestic relations cases, or reasonable attorney's fees as we provided for this last session in probate cases, as you well understand, are fees between private parties.
Certainly.
We have to talk about a situation, I think, here that if it is solely upon the reasonableness of the compensation in each given case, and it's solely up to the judge to determine that reasonableness, I can foresee, from a strictly budgetary standpoint, the county's having a hell of a time trying to budget this kind of compensation. We can't escape that fact. I mean, as I said earlier, we have to be cognizant of giving the counties something that they can budget with. Now, Mr. Hinkson feels that under this language of reasonable compensation, that the counties would have the latitude to adopt a reasonable fee schedule. I think that's something we'll have to take up in work session and determine for ourselves whether we feel that that language would give that flexibility or not. But that's all I want to know on that. Are there any other questions from committee members on these two bills? Okay, I think we'll take about a 5-minute recess and then come back on House Bill 2199.
Got you.
I don't like these soft gavels.
Let the record show.
Let the record show after the clerk has pulled the earphones out of her inner ear. And Okay, does anybody else, before we move on, wish to add any further testimony to House Bill 2198? All right, we'll go on then to House Bill 2199. And again, Mr. Hankson, you've signed up for this, so would you please go ahead. I gather that based on our discussions on 2198, where we've talked about the quality of defense counsel as it relates to what quality a good dollar will buy, we're going on into trying to set up some standards here. Is that right?
Yes. With regard to House Bill 2199, I'd like to explain what the amendments are and why the committee and the Oregon State Bar recommends this change. The language that is new is suitable counsel possessing skills and experience commensurate with the nature of the charge and the complexity of the case is what we now are proposing. A lawyer that would be able to handle it, for instance, a driving under the influence charge, may very well not possess skills and experience that would permit that lawyer to do an effective job of representing an individual charged with armed robbery or murder, for instance. And we have instances where ineffective assistance of counsel was rendered because counsel was appointed for a defendant that did not possess skills and experience commensurate with the nature of the charge and complexity of the case, that resulted in the reversal of a conviction on the basis of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Chair. Yes, Representative Gardner.
Who is going to determine who possesses skills and experience commensurate with the nature of the charge and complexity of the case? Who makes that decision?
The court.
That's the judge.
Or if we have a public defender system, if the public defender would have a guideline that I'm sure that they're following now, but they would have a guideline here from the statute that would say that when the court doesn't appoint a specific individual, that the public defender, the organization itself, chooses an individual that does possess the skills commensurate with the nature of the charge and the complexity of the case.
Okay, and this would be on, Mr. Chairman, this would be on any case, any court-appointed case?
Yes.
Okay. And at what point does someone, is there a minimum point that your certificate into the practice of law entitles you to engage in criminal law practice?
Well, I must say that I don't think that a lawyer that's never tried a jury trial should be thrown into the breach of defending someone in a jury trial and murder charge.
Okay.
That's the other side of the coin.
What about a traffic citation? Would be competent to handle a traffic citation?
Possibly.
Possibly.
However, you see, each case, we're dealing with the realities of life, and like I indicated, say, like the little traffic charge lodged against Hugh Duffy Brown became one of the most fascinating legal constitutional battles that ever was waged in this state since I've been here. So that had that issue, that charge was not a substantial one, but the complexity of that case, the issue involved in that case, was immense.
If I might continue. So under your envisionment of how this system would work, each individual judge would be making decisions upon those cases to which he would be appointing counsel as to whether the individual he appointed possessed skills and experience commensurate with the nature of the charge and complexity of the case. Is that accurate?
Where the judge was involved in the appointment process, as opposed to just a defender organization.
Yes. Do judges, in your experience, vary as far as their opinions as to the skill and ability and nature of the charges in particular cases and individuals that come before them?
Yes, they're humans.
Okay. do you think that there is at least the potential in allowing the judge to make this determination that perhaps some individuals would not have the ability, that might have the ability to practice on particular cases?
You're looking at the recipient of 3 years of no court-appointed cases in Clackamas County that I didn't think had anything to do with my effectiveness, and as much as I had been successful in securing a number of reversals.
And yet you're willing to allow the judge basically to make that determination on a case-by-case basis, knowing that he's a human being with prejudices and biases that may have nothing to do with experience and competency?
The world isn't perfect. Somebody's got to make the decision, and where we do have the court actively involved in the appointment of counsel, we are better off with this language than we were with the language of the present law. At least he now has some guidelines, where before he didn't.
What guidelines do you think that the judges were using presently to determine whether or not to appoint an individual to a case?
Each individual judge would vary on this, of course.
What things would he take into consideration before he would appoint an individual to a case? Would it be the complexity of the case, the skill and experience of the attorney?
Those are matters that I'm sure have been taken into consideration. There are some other things that have been taken into consideration.
Such as?
Whether this young lawyer needed a case to start his practice going, or to continue it going.
Okay. I have any further at this point.
Representative Richards.
What happens, how is ineffective aid of counsel pursued by a defendant?
Within the context of the defendant seeking freedom, it's a very difficult process. As I've indicated, if you have a trial record that indicates ineffective assistance of counsel, the general rule, subject to an exception that none of us have seen yet in this state, is that it may not be raised on appeal. You have to exhaust the appellate process and then go back to circuit court on a post-conviction relief petition.
As a practical
matter. And then allege ineffective assistance of counsel.
So you have to go all the way through the appeals process on the merits of the
Yes, usually there's going to be more than one issue in a case.
Mm-hmm.
Ineffective assistance is, I might point out in this area that through my work, I have come into contact with lawyers that frequently travel to the penitentiary that have seen quite a lot of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
As a practical matter, a defendant that's convicted may be able to make one appeal, make one level of appeal. And as a practical matter, ineffective aid of counsel is seldom heard in a court of law. Isn't that the truth?
In a direct appeal.
All right, I'm not understanding. How often is the issue of ineffective aid of counsel raised by an indigent defendant?
Not enough.
No, how? But do you have any idea?
I just got Bob Penn's criminal law newsletter. I saw in the case of Sims versus Cup, one of the ways to find out is that might be easy is to go through the Oregon Digest and find the table of cases, and every time White Cup gets sued, you can go through there and find that. But we have so many unwritten opinions, but it's impossible to say. I mean, there isn't any one lawyer that is familiar with all of the appellate court briefs that get filed with the Court of Appeals to answer that question. I'm sure that it happens at least once a month, but maybe once a week or maybe more.
What is a practical effect of this bill? In fact, it doesn't really change anything, does it?
It gives the court a statutory guideline and direction
same folks are going to be making the same decisions. And this is just simply a policy statement in the statute that they're supposed to go by to make the decisions that they were making before.
It gives them a standard for making the decision that they did not have embodied in the statute. There's a statutory mandate.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Hinkson. Does this simply, in essence, codify the Ruck versus Kapp decision? And
it doesn't go beyond it.
Okay, but it's a fair statement to say that it does, in essence, codify what is already required by a court decision.
It focuses on the nature of the charge and complexity of the case, something that is not specifically mentioned in Rook versus Cuff. That standard there was what would a reasonably competent criminal defense practitioner have done in those circumstances.
Okay, but I guess the concomitant of that is that you are required to have a reasonably competent criminal defense practitioner under the circumstances in every case.
Yes.
Where it needs to be appointed. Okay. Let me ask you this. I'm curious under, about line 19 of the bill, you indicate that appointed counsel is not to be denied because an individual may have the ability to pay a portion of the cost of adequate representation. What happens when you get into a situation under your House Bill 2197 where you tell a part-time public defender that he can't engage in private criminal defense work, and yet you got a defendant who's not totally indigent but can't afford the full, bear the full load?
Would I think that would be the private practice of criminal law?
Well, it seems to me it would.
What this portion of the act would do, we would hope, would to be prohibit what we've seen in the past, where an individual is not totally indigent, but the quality of defense services that they're able to purchase with that dollar does not give them an entry into the marketplace of competent defense practitioners. Now, this would permit, we would hope, the individual that is charged to either pay into the court or pay to the private practitioner who happens to be a non-public defender and allow that private practitioner engaging in indigent defense in this particular instance to make application to the court for additional fees.
Let me give you what I foresee could be a very real possibility in this area. We've received a report from Legislative Research that estimates that the cost of a capital case, a death penalty case in Oregon, will run about $30,000 at a minimum. And let's say that you have a defendant that probably could afford to pay even $10,000. Is it your contemplation under this provision here, or a similar provision that we might work out, that that individual would be required to foot the bill, say, for $10,000, but also be entitled to court-appointed counsel on the balance?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not sure that the language does that, but if that is what you intend to provide, and then I guess counsel would at least hold that for work session, is that if we want to go that way, and it, I can foresee in a capital case in particular, where if we're looking at $30,000 cost of indigent or cost of defense, it could very well be a number of people who could, you know, could pay part but not all. The other question I have is that you are throwing in here also a provision that the counsel must be appointed for any other proceeding which subjects a person to possible loss of liberty or substantial quasi-criminal sanctions. Pray tell me, what are substantial quasi-criminal sanctions?
The answer is found in UW Brown versus Multnomah County District Court.
Well, I've read that time and time and time again, and I'm still not sure that I can tell you what quasi-criminal sanctions are. I've asked some of the justices that too, and I don't think they can tell me what quasi-criminal sanctions are. What do you, is that all we have to go on, is the Brown case?
Well, we have, it's progeny. The case that indicates that, I believe, reckless driving has the earmarks of a crime, no matter what you call it, an infraction. The court is going to be left free to make its decision as to what, on a case-by-case basis, is or is not a crime within the sense of the constitutional definition of crime. This merely is an implementation of the mandate of UW Brown versus Multnomah County District Court.
Okay, any other questions from members of the committee? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Clayton Patrick?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Clayton Patrick. I'm representing the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Once again, I'd like to be brief on this, but the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association also supports House Bill 2199. In response to some of the questions that the Representative Gardner raised with regard to who would be making the determinations of what attorney had the skills and experience commensurate, I'm certain he's probably more familiar with the process than I am, but it's got to be a personal thing between the judges and the attorneys who get represented, which is the way it is now. The various judges who make these appointments know the attorneys who are on the appointments list, and they, you know, select attorneys and call attorneys to be appointed on individual cases. All this is doing is saying that a defendant has the right to have a more experienced counsel in a case where it's a real serious crime. And if it's a, you know, first-time shoplifting misdemeanor, then that's the kind of case for the young practitioner just out of law school to handle, because, you know, that they can handle without any real difficulty. I think a more important aspect of the bill, and once again an aspect which I'm sure you're going to be concerned about as far as costs are concerned, but one that I think is a real problem, is this question of defendant being entitled to adequate counsel, even though he's able to pay, you know, some counsel to handle his case or his or her case. Quite often we'll have the situation where a cost-conscious judge, and perhaps correctly so, being concerned about costs, will determine that a defendant can afford to obtain some attorney in town, but that defendant really doesn't have the resources to retain an attorney that he or she really needs if it's a murder one case or something similar, where it's going to be a really complicated case. Maybe they can afford to hire the attorney fresh out of law school, but they're not going to be able to hire someone who will really be able to give them adequate representation. Now, you know, I can certainly see why you'd want to consider the whole question of costs along with this matter. But speaking just simply from the standpoint of trying to provide minimally adequate counsel, I think this bill is a step in the right direction. Other than to tell you that we support the bill, I would just answer any questions that you might have.
You would support the concept that we discussed earlier then about perhaps providing or allowing for indigent defense or defense costs for an individual, where an individual could in fact afford to pay part of his.
Oh, absolutely, payments. Absolutely. I think that's an excellent approach. There's no reason why the indigent shouldn't pay that portion that he or she is able to pay, and then if more is needed to give adequate representation, then the balance is taken care of.
Let me ask you this. I know that. At least our experience in Jackson County has been that the judges quite often, as either a condition of probation or suspending a position of sentence or what have you, have required that the defendant make restitution to the county for indigent defense costs.
Is that a practice that's engaged in, to your knowledge, in Marion County or any other counties that you're aware of?
Washington.
Multnomah.
I believe it has been on occasion, yes, in the appropriate circumstances.
I think that's the way they get around it today.
Once again, I don't have any real difficulty with that, as long as it's based on the on the person's ability to pay, and they're given an opportunity.
That's my knowledge. It is that different kind of inquiries made. Representative Smith.
I guess I'd just make the comment along those lines too, that I'm not sure whether it's codified or more in standing as a court rule, but most judges who make appointments are allowed to consider a person's minimal property. In other words, they don't have to sell their only shelter or perhaps their only automobile. Or their only substance or subsistence money, they don't have to put all this forward. It's usually money only forward and above that that is looked at for possible retention of counsel before court-appointed counsel is given.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments by committee members?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any other witnesses wishing to testify on House Bill 2199? All right, we declare the public hearings closed on the bills that we've heard today. Let's go back now and see if the committee wishes to take any action at this time on any of the bills. I would say this, that on 2198 and 2199, it would seem to me to be appropriate to set these two over at least for work session to explore some of our alternative ways of at least trying to accomplish what is intended by these bills, or possibly even adopting the bills in close to their current form. But 2196, 2197, what are the desires of the committee? Representative Gardner.
Well, a statement and a motion. First of all, the scope of 2196 is obviously very, very limited. It apparently is not any great problem or any problem at this point in time that it seeks to correct, but rather it's brought to us in the form of being something that should not happen in the future. At the most, it's probably going to affect, if it ever did affect anyone, probably two or three people. And I feel personally that that the better way to handle this is through an advisory opinion from the State Bar Association's Ethics Committee, rather than sending this particular piece of legislation through the process to the House floor, over to the Senate, through Senate committees, to the Senate floor, and then perhaps to the governor, if in fact it made it that far.
Before I accept the motion and Representative Gardner, is anybody else in the committee that wishes to comment on this bill? All right, your motion.
Yeah, I would move to table House Bill 2196.
Representative Gardner has moved to table House Bill 2196. The motion is not debatable. The clerk will call the roll.
Yes.
Motion to table 2196.
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye. Call Representative Richards?
Representative Richards?
Aye.
I guess we do have enough votes. All right. 2196 then is tabled.
You need four votes, that's all.
That's all we need in the subcommittee. Anybody wish to take any action on House Bill 2197?
I've got a comment, and then I haven't decided whether to make a motion yet,
okay.
But I'll make the comment and see if anyone else has.
Representative Gardner.
Okay. this strikes me as something that would be better handled by an ethics opinion. However, it does have a much wider potential, I guess, application, since there are more counties and there are more public defenders. One of the things that concerns me about sending the bill on is the fact that the primary witness that testified on the bill was not able to tell us of any instance in which this activity was taking place, and secondly, the question as to whether there is anyone who is working in the public defender's office that is making in excess of less than $13,000, that the amendments to the existing law would apply to. You're really talking about a part-time county public defender, I suppose, and perhaps there are some people that are in that category. I think that if the committee has a desire to work with this bill, that there isn't any reason to make a distinction between civil and criminal practice, because the evil that is sought to be corrected is actually one that applies equally as well as to civil as well as criminal representation in those circumstances. I would be amenable, if the committee were to vote to table the bill, to take the bill off the table and send it along if there was anyone, A, that was going to be affected, and B, that there had been some kind of a problem.
Yes, Representative Richards.
As between 2196 and 2197 and the language in both of them, I am still frankly confused about what practice of law specifically we are proscribing or prohibiting.
Okay, I think my final question cleared that up in my own mind as to what it meant, and it's simply this, that where you have a public defender, regardless of the amount of money, that is, the amount of the salary of that public defender, 2197 would prohibit that public defender from engaging in any private criminal defense work. Would not be able to do any criminal defense work for a fee. And it gets to one of the situations I think that bothers me most about 2197 is that if in fact we do have part-time public defenders anywhere in the state, and principally, say, in the eastern part of the state, who have a substantial civil practice on the side, and whose own clients get into a criminal problem and want the public defender, or the individual who is the public defender, to represent them, I think that works an unnecessary hardship and unfairness on that relationship. Granted, we know what the evil is that we're trying to avoid, but I think that we are sweeping under that rug where the situation where you could have a perfectly legitimate case that I described where a part-time public defender has been representing so-and-so for years, doing all of his business work and what have you, and gets into a DUII situation or something like that, and comes to public defender, part-time public defender, and says, I want you to represent me. You're the best around. You're my attorney. And this law would prohibit that. And that's the other side of the coin of 2197. Representative Smith.
Probably my fault for not bringing it out in questioning, but I guess I've had some trouble looking at the ethical concerns of these two bills and distinguishing between the role of a public defender and the role of a private attorney who is court-appointed as counsel. And as Representative Gardner, perhaps you, Representative Lombard, have experienced, you find yourself being summoned to the courthouse to meet on a very brief basis, really in the role of a public defender. You have been asked to give up your time, and you're there, and you have the same opportunity to perpetuate the evil that is in this bill, or that is trying to be blocked by this bill. In a conversation a while ago with Representative Richards, it occurred to me that there have been a number of times when I, as a court-appointed attorney, have been in the interview room with a new client, and the client says, by the way, although I don't have any money now, I had this automobile wreck here last year, and I know there's a good case here. If you want to take it for me, can you help me with it? Perhaps there is something explicitly on point from the bar on that, but it's a very common occurrence, and yet I don't see this bill addressing the total picture. It just limits the public defender, and I'm not sure that there's any real difference between these two roles, court-appointed counsel and public defender.
Representative Richards.
would this bill go to, the question of an indigent who's just finished his interview with his criminal defense lawyer and who has a civil matter that he wants to have addressed? So it's only criminal, it's only criminal representation.
No, would not address that.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments by committee members? Representative Smith?
I moved to table this bill and would have the same willingness as expressed by Representative Gardner, perhaps.
Okay, you've heard the motion to table House Bill 2197. The motion is not debatable. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Cohen?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Schoenmeyer?
Aye. Okay, House Bill 2197 is tabled. As I indicated before, unless there is any real sentiment to take any action on 2198 or 2199 at this time, it would be my intention that we carry those two over to work session. Representative Gardner.
Just a comment, since we've been a little tough on Mr. Hinkson and kind of stomped on him while he was still here, I would just make the comment that I think that although the committee decided to table both the bills, the questions and my comments notwithstanding, I think the House bills 2198 and 2199 are important bills, and particularly 2198, because I think that Mr. Vincent's comments regarding how the system works, as well as the cost and the effectiveness of the representation, are all very much tied to the amount of money that the attorney is able to engender, and I think that this committee will take some kind of positive action, although it may not be the specific language Mr. Hinkson has recommended in House Bill 2198 to attempt to address that, notwithstanding what happens to the Indigent Defense Bill going to Ways and Means.
I think it's a good point, and I would also like to say we may have seemed a bit abrupt on your first two bills. I certainly appreciate your taking the time to come down here and testify, give us as thorough testimony and as in-depth testimony as you have, and I know those of us who served on this committee last session, would feel that the quality of your testimony has really improved the bar's image, I think, and the bar's testimony tremendously over last session, and those of us who are practicing lawyers who were particularly upset last session that the bar was not coming down and doing a good job in support of their bills, I think would say that your testimony is an indication of a great improvement of that, and I certainly do appreciate that. Okay, I think that's all we have for the day. Declare the committee adjourned.
Kip, is there anything that you want